Today is February the 26th, 2025. I'm Hank Key, and welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. Many of us are reminded of the importance of warmth and comfort. Unfortunately, not everyone has access to proper winter clothing. Donating winter coats helps those in need stay warm during the colder months. By donating your gently used or new winter coats, you contribute to the community support initiatives that aim to keep vulnerable populations safe and warm during the harsh winter conditions. Contact local charities and organizations that accept clothing donations. You can use search engines by typing in the keywords such as winter coat donation near me, or you can type in coat drive near me for more targeted results. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Apple launched the iPhone 16e, marking a significant shift as it is the first iPhone to feature an Apple-designed modem, moving away from Qualcomm's technology. This transition is part of Apple's strategy to reduce its dependency on Qualcomm and enhance its self-reliance in critical smartphone components. The iPhone 16e is positioned as a more budget-friendly option within Apple's lineup, priced at $599. The iPhone 16e offers most of the features from the iPhone 16 for $200 less. Apple has officially announced the iPhone 16e, which is more of an addition to the iPhone 16 family than a replacement for the 2022 iPhone SE. The name makes sense, as the iPhone 16e is closer in design, features, and specs to the iPhone 16 lineup than it is to Apple's previous entry-level offering. It isn't as affordable, however, starting at $599 for 128 gigabytes, it's $170 more than the $429 iPhone SE. Even so, the iPhone 16e looks to be a promising alternative to the $799 iPhone 16. Apple ditches the old-school design of the 2022 iPhone SE in favor of a look more consistent with the company's most recent devices. The iPhone 16e has an aluminum frame and the company's ceramic shield glass on the front. Apple says the phone has an IP68 rating for dust and water resistance, which matches most flagship phones across the industry. The iPhone 16e comes in matte black or matte white, and Apple says 5 new silicon cases will be available in black, fuchsia, lake green, white, or the phone has a larger 6.1-inch Super Retina XDR OLED display that stretches from top to bottom and side to side, though it has a notch at the top like the iPhone 14 rather than the dynamic island of the latest iPhones. The screen gains pixels in addition to size. Apple says it has the same pixel density of 460 pixels per inch as the other 6.1-inch iPhones with a resolution of 2532 by 1170 pixels. The screen supports HDR, True Tone, and Wide Color P3. It puts out up to 1200 nits at peak brightness, which is far brighter than the iPhone SE. The iPhone SE gains the action button of the iPhone 16 family, but not the dedicated camera control. The iPhone 16e drops the Lightning port in favor of USB-C, and this puts the phone in compliance with the latest regulations from the European Union, which mandates all small electronics use USB-C. Most of Apple's product line has already adopted USB-C. The iPhone 16e sticks to USB 2.0 speeds up to 480 megabits per second. The iPhone 16e uses the A16 processor. It's based on a 3-nanometer process and has a 6-core CPU, a 4-core GPU, and a 16-core NPU, that's the neural engine. It means a phone will be able to run the latest operating system and the latest apps. Often, silicon is the biggest factor limiting operating system upgrades for older devices. The iPhone SE relied on the A15, which is many generations out of date and simply not able to keep up anymore. The A16 ensures that the iPhone 16e will be relevant for at least 4 or 5 years. Last, newer processors are more efficient than older ones. One of the iPhone SE's biggest weaknesses was battery life. Paired with a larger battery, the iPhone 16e should get you through a bigger portion of the day. Apple claims the 16e has the best battery life of any 6.1-inch iPhone, with up to 26 hours of video playback, 6 hours more than the iPhone 11, and 12 hours more than any iPhone SE. Apple says using a 20-watt wired adapter, the phone can charge up to 50% in 30 minutes. Also, the phone supports wireless charging. Then there's connectivity with a custom modem. Along with the iPhone 16e, Apple debuted its first modem, which it calls the C1. Apple has, until now, relied on modems from Intel and Qualcomm for the iPhone cellular connectivity. This marks the first iPhone with a modem designed by Apple. It's probably the most important change for this and future iPhones. It allows Apple to control more of how the iPhone connects and uses other system resources, like power. The A3212 model supports 5G new radio, including most low and mid-band spectrum used in North America. This includes bands N77 and N78 for C-band. The phone does not support mmWave. The phone also includes support for legacy LTE 4G, 3G, and 2G networks. Importantly, the 5G radio supports 4x4 MIMO. The old iPhone SE, for example, supported only 2x2 MIMO. The iPhone 16e also supports Wi-Fi 6 with 2x2 MIMO, Bluetooth 5.3, and NFC radio for tap-and-go mobile payments, and express cards with power reserve. Last, GPS, GLONASS, Galileo, Baidu, and iBeacon microlocation are on board for assistance with location and maps. Microsoft has decided to allow Windows 11 to be installed on older PCs, but there's a catch. In a surprising shift, Microsoft has decided to allow Windows 11 to be installed on older PCs that don't meet the original hardware requirements. This move opens up the latest versions of Windows to a wider audience, including those still using legacy machines. But while the door has been opened, there are some important considerations and caveats you should be aware of before diving in. The end of Windows 10 support drives change. With Windows 10 approaching its end of support deadline in October of this year, many users are beginning to consider their next steps. According to Microsoft, over 60% of users are still using Windows 10, and that statistic likely reflects the reality for many home users, schools, and businesses. For these groups, upgrading to Windows 11 may not have seemed feasible due to strict hardware requirements, such as the need for a TPM 2.0 security module, which is only available on newer PCs. However, in an unexpected turn of events, Microsoft has decided to relax these installation rules, meaning that users with older hardware can now install Windows 11. But before you get excited, it's important to understand the limitations and risks involved with this decision. And what's the catch? Limited support and persistent reminders. If you're thinking of installing Windows 11 on a system that does not meet the minimum hardware requirements, be prepared for some challenges. Microsoft has made it clear that these unsupported systems won't receive official support, and the performance or stability of the OS on these systems is not guaranteed. Even more crucially, your system could be excluded from essential security updates, which could expose your machine to vulnerabilities over time. Additionally, as a constant reminder of your system's unsupported status, you'll see a watermark on your desktop, and notifications will appear regularly in the settings menu. While these reminders won't interfere with day-to-day usage, they do serve as a constant nudge to think about upgrading your hardware. Then there's a grace period for reverting to Windows 10. For those who are willing to try Windows 11 on unsupported hardware, there is a 10-day grace period to revert back to Windows 10 if things don't go as planned. If you experience compatibility or performance issues, you can roll back to your previous operating system during this window. It's a nice safety net for anyone who is uncertain about the transition. To check if your PC meets the minimal requirements for Windows 11, Microsoft still recommends using the PC Health Check tool, which will let you know if your device can handle the upgrade without running into problems. Why Microsoft made this move? So, why did Microsoft relax these requirements in the first place? For many users, upgrading hardware to meet the original demands of Windows 11 simply isn't feasible. This is especially true for schools, businesses, and other institutions with tight budgets. Replacing large fleets of machines to meet the hardware specs for the new operating system is an expensive proposition. By easing these restrictions, Microsoft is aiming to balance accessibility with the need for security and performance. It's a compromise that allows users to experience the latest operating system even if they can't afford to upgrade the hardware. But you got to weigh your options. What's the best path forward? If you're unsure about upgrading, consider your options carefully. And here are some of the alternatives. Upgrade your hardware. The safest option is to invest in a new PC that meets all the requirements for Windows 11. This guarantees full compatibility and access to all updates and features. Or install a TPM 2.0 chip for some older systems if it was possible. Adding a TPM module, which some motherboards support, is a cost-effective way to meet the security requirements for Windows 11. Another option is to stick with Windows 10 for now, while support lasting until 2025. Windows 10 is still a perfectly viable option, especially if you're not ready to upgrade just yet. And of course, explore alternatives. If you're looking to move away from Microsoft altogether, there are alternative operating systems like Linux, which can run smoothly on older hardware and offer strong security and flexibility. You may want to consider striking a delicate balance. Microsoft's decision to allow Windows 11 on older hardware is a clear acknowledgement of the challenges many users face when it comes to transitioning to modern operating systems. Windows 11 introduces cost-cutting security and performance features that are designed for today's hardware, but accessibility remains a concern. This compromise allows more users to try the latest operating system, but it comes with trade-offs. While installing Windows 11 on unsupported hardware might work for now, the lack of guaranteed support and updates can pose significant risk in the future. The decision to move forward really depends on your willingness to accept these limitations, if you're ready to embrace a hardware upgrade for the best experience possible. In the end, technology is all about flexibility. If you're willing to take on some risk and understand the potential consequences, upgrading to Windows 11 on an older machine can breathe new life into your system. Just make sure you're fully aware of the catch before you take the plunge. And as always, before you try any upgrade at all, make sure you have completed all necessary backups of your operating system and your information data. HP is acquiring Humane's assets, but shutting down the AI pin business and bricking existing units. The Humane AI pin generated a lot of buzz ahead of launch as Humane positioned it as a brand new category for mobile devices that would leverage artificial intelligence to let you perform all sorts of tasks without a phone or PC. It was a spectacular flop at launch, with reviewers complaining that the product was overpriced and the core service could have just been a smartphone app. Within a few months, the company was said to be talking to HP about the possibility of acquiring Humane for $1 billion. Today, the company's announced a deal where HP will buy some of Humane's assets, but it will be for just over one-tenth of the price Humane had originally sought. The deal, which is expected to close by the end of the month, will have HP pay $116 million for software, intellectual property, which includes more than 300 patents and patent applications, and personnel, which Bloomberg News reports, which amounts to the majority of Humane's employees. One thing HP doesn't want, the AI pin itself. According to Bloomberg, the hardware business will shut down, and a message on the Humane website thanks early supporters who are using AI pin hardware and informs them with a message stating as follows. Device timeline. Your AI pin will continue to function normally until 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on February the 28th, 2025. After this date, it will no longer connect to Humane's servers, and dot center access will be fully retired. That means AI pins will no longer include calling, messaging, AI queries and responses, or cloud access, and user data will be deleted from the Humane servers. The company recommends making backups immediately. There is no mention of refunds or any form of compensation for customers who may have spent as much as $699 plus subscription fees to become early adopters. The only refunds that will be offered are for customers that have purchased a device within the past 90 days, since they're still within the 90-day return window. So what does HP get out of this? The PC maker is said to be planning to create a new division that will be headed up by Humane co-founders Imran Chaudhry and Bethany Bongiorno, who had previously worked at Apple. The goal is to find ways to bring AI features to HP hardware, including personal computers, printers, and connected conference rooms. That's hardly surprising. Pretty much every major tech company is investing heavily in AI these days. What remains to be seen is whether there's enough demand to justify that investment, and or whether this is something that's actually going to distinguish one PC or printer brand from another at a time when not only are most competitors doing something similar, but Microsoft is building AI features directly into the Windows operating system that powers most non-Apple PCs, with the exception of a handful of models that ship with GNU Linux distributions. Chase will block Zelle payment transactions. Chase says making payments over social media is too messy, and they will block Zelle transactions. The new policy starts in March of 2025. The next time you go to pay someone, you might run into some unexpected friction from Zelle, especially if you're a Chase customer. As spotted by Bleeping Computer, Chase is updating its user policy to reflect that it will start blocking payments made through Zelle to social media contacts in an effort to cut down on fraudulent transactions. The policy, which will go into effect on March the 23rd, 2025, will mark a level of increased scrutiny from Chase on any transaction that appears to be for an online purchase made through social media, whether that is buying something from an online marketplace or making a trade with a connection from a Reddit community. According to Chase, if the receiving party of a Zelle transfer is identified as originating from contact through social media, the bank may choose to decline or block that payment from going through. It may also ask for some more details regarding the transaction before letting it go through. For example, Chase says it may ask you to explain the purpose of payment, the method of contact with your recipient, or other details they deem appropriate to assess whether your payment has elevated fraud or scam risk, or is an illegal, ineligible, or improper payment. According to Chase, this new level of scrutiny stems from a flood of fraud related to social media transactions. The banking giant claims that 50% of all fraud claims filed by its Zelle customers originated on social media. It's not the only place noticing the uptick. NatWest Bank published its own findings regarding fraud and found that social media marketplace scams are the second fastest growing scam affecting customers. It also found that 60% of users between the ages of 18 to 24 reported either personally experiencing financial loss from an online scam or knowing someone who has fallen victim. Anyone who pays through Zelle is also likely well aware there is no refund option. As far as the banks that operate Zelle are concerned, these transactions are just a digital version of handing someone cash. Whatever reasons you have for doing that is between you and the recipient. And if they don't hold up their end of the bargain, you're on your own. This has been a major pain point for consumers and ignores the fact that Zelle often is not used to split a bill among friends, but to partake in commerce. Last year, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau accused Zelle of failing to protect its users who lost a collective $870 million to scams since Zelle's launch in 2017. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau claims Zelle doesn't sufficiently verify users and doesn't track down known fraudsters even when it receives reports from users about the scam activity. So Chase's policy change could certainly be viewed as a response to those charges. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, how they impact us, and how to be better in the workplace through technology. And I recently did a question from a gentleman by the name of Jordan, and he asked about how to stay relevant in a tech-driven marketplace. And Mike reached out to me and he said, look, I do the same job day in, day out. And look, this idea of just learning new stuff, learning is hard. Learning is difficult. Do I really need to do this? And the answer to Mike is this. Look, yes, you do. You do not want to be left behind. You don't want to be the guy that's sitting there and goes, look, I do my job and I come in, I do my job, and I go home at the end of the day. That's not going to help you for the long term. Look at Mike over there. He's doing the job the same way he's done it for the last 10 years. Look, Mike, I don't mean to pick on you. We all need to embrace the idea of change. We need to practice this. We should never be resisting change, especially in the workplace. And there are people who never change and they will get left behind. There are people who change and they'll keep up to date. I'll tell you though, the best way to get ahead is to be the one who sees opportunity in that change, who sees the opportunity to be more efficient, to get things done quicker, to perform more of the tasks in a day than the other people. You need to find the way to be better at what you're doing. Sure, you may be doing a great job today, and you may be getting great reviews on the work you're doing, but what if you can improve that? What if you can do more in less time? That is what employers see as an absolute just benefit to the company. And you may not be in a technical role per se, but as I mentioned, as I continually mention over the course of my stint here on the radio, everybody is going into technology and they're utilizing technology. And if you can utilize technology better than the guy next to you, you will become a greater value. Technology is a tool. It's a hammer. And there are guys out there. There are roofers out there. They go on out. They go out on the roof and they put the new roof onto the house or the business or wherever they're at. And they're doing the same thing every day and they just work. But there are guys out there that say, hey, I can do this and I can be a little bit more efficient. I no longer have to use just a regular, pardon me, I'm not a roofer. I don't know all of this. So if I use a slightly heavier hammer, I can drive the nails in faster. Ooh, I can actually use one of these pneumatic hammering guns and I can put those nails in even faster. That's technology. Technology surrounds us. And we've had technology for ages. It's just an improvement. It's just a different way of doing things than we've done before. And we become more efficient with this. There are ways in everybody's jobs out there. If you're dealing with a computer for 4 hours a day, 8 hours a day, whatever it is, you may find that there are ways to utilize technology to reduce the time to do that task. If it takes you 20 minutes to do a task, but you can automate part of that task because you do the same task every day, you can spend 5 hours, 10 hours reducing that task on down to a shorter task. If you can slowly reduce that down, that task that takes 20 minutes down to 15 minutes, if you do that task a matter of 10 times a day and you've lopped off 5 minutes of that task, you have restored nearly an hour back into your day that you can use elsewhere. And there are so many different things that are out there. AI will help you with this. AI is an amazing thing out there as long as you treat AI like it should be treated, as a tool, as something that helps you be a little bit better at your job. That's going to be great. Automation is wonderful. But along the way, as you learn this technology, people are going to take interest in how you improved how you're doing work, and they will see that. And if you can explain, look, so this is how I shaved off 5 minutes for this task. I did this. If you can explain how you did it, you explain that what is perhaps a tech concept or even a complex tech concept to non-technical people, to the coworkers who aren't doing that, you become a greater asset in the workplace than the person who's just sitting there doing the same thing every day, day in, day out. find people who can help you utilize that technology better. Yes, frequently it's in the IT department, but sometimes it's going to be the coworkers sitting next to you and you say, hey, how did you complete that in 15 minutes? It takes me 20 minutes. Strive to be a better person, a better worker, a better value to your company, to your workplace. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Stanford scientists just found a faster and cheaper way to store carbon permanently. A team at Stanford has developed a powerful yet low-energy way to trap atmospheric CO2 using heated minerals. By enhancing the natural weathering process, the technique creates reactive materials that absorb carbon at unprecedented rates. This scalable approach could integrate with agriculture and industry, removing carbon while benefiting crops and soil. Stanford University chemists have developed a practical and affordable way to permanently remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, helping to combat global warming. Their new process uses heat to modify common minerals, turning them into highly reactive materials that naturally absorb and store CO2. These materials can be produced in standard kilns similar to those used in cement manufacturing. The Earth has an inexhaustible supply of minerals that are capable of removing CO2 from the atmosphere, but they just don't react fast enough on their own to counteract human greenhouse gas emissions, says Matthew Kanin, a professor of chemistry in the Stanford School of Humanities and Sciences and senior author of the study published recently in Nature. Our work solves this problem in a way that we think is uniquely scalable. In nature, common minerals called silicates react with water and atmospheric CO2 to form stable bicarbonate ions and solid carbonate minerals, a process known as weathering. However, this reaction can take hundreds to thousands of years to complete. Since the 1990s, scientists have been searching for ways to make rocks absorb carbon dioxide more rapidly through enhanced weathering techniques. Kanin and Stanford postdoctoral scholar Yuxian Shen developed and demonstrated in their lab a new process for converting slow-weathering silicates into much more reactive minerals that capture and store atmospheric carbon quickly. A grant from the Sustainability Accelerator at the Stanford Dora School of Sustainability is now supporting efforts to move the research into practical applications. We envision a new chemistry to activate the inert silicate minerals through a simple ion exchange reaction, said Chen, lead author of the study, who developed the technique while earning a chemistry PhD in Kanin's lab. We didn't expect that it would work as well as it does. Our process would require less than half the energy used by leading direct air capture technologies, and we think we can be very competitive from a cost point of view, said Kanin, who's also a senior fellow at the Prescott Institute for Energy in the Stanford Dora School of Sustainability. The new approach was inspired by a centuries-old technique for making cement. Cement production begins by converting limestone to calcium oxide in a kiln heated to about 1400 degrees Celsius. The calcium oxide is then mixed with sand to produce a key ingredient in cement. The Stanford team used a similar process in their laboratory furnace, but instead of sand, they combined calcium oxide with another mineral containing magnesium and silicate ions. When heated, the two minerals swap ions and transform into magnesium oxide and calcium silicate, two alkaline materials that react quickly with acidic CO2 in the air. The process acts as a multiplier, Kanin said. You take one reactive mineral, calcium oxide, and a magnesium silicate that is more or less inert, and you generate two reactive minerals. I think we have a very enlightening process that may take hold and be scalable. The technology in the Chinese high-altitude balloon. In early 2023, a Chinese spy balloon crossed over the United States, raising national security concerns. The balloon was reportedly equipped with technology from at least five American companies, including Iridium and Texas Instruments. The discovery has since led to claims of potential espionage activities. The balloon, measuring 200 feet, was shot down by the U.S. military off the South Carolina coast on February 4, 2023. Investigations revealed that the equipment recovered was capable of extensive data collection on American infrastructure. A Chinese embassy spokesperson claimed the strain of the Chinese civilian unmanned airship into the U.S. airspace was an accident caused by force majeure, adding, the airship, used for meteorological research, unintentionally drifted into U.S. because of the westerlies and its limited self-steering capability. However, it managed to cover all the strategic points in the United States. An inside source stated, the technology matches that in a patent awarded in 2022 to scientists at the Chinese Academy of Sciences Aerospace Information Innovation Research Institute in Beijing, which has links to China's military and to its industrial defense base. The source added, the patent included a short burst messaging communications messaging module called Iridium 9602, made by Iridium, a global satellite communications provider based in McLean, Virginia, and coincidentally less than 5 miles from CIA headquarters. Some surveillance equipment was stored in a foam cooler, raising questions about the sophistication of its protective measures. While Beijing claims the balloon was a meteorological device that accidentally entered U.S. space, U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded otherwise. The Iridium 9602 module is widely utilized in military applications due to its ability to provide global, reliable, and secure satellite communications. While the search results do not explicitly mention military-specific uses, the module's features and capabilities make it highly suitable for defense-related operations. And these are some of the potential military operations based on its functionality. Asset and personnel tracking. The Iridium 9602 is ideal for tracking military vehicles, equipment, and personnel in remote or hostile environments where traditional communication networks are unavailable. Its integration into tracking devices ensures real-time location updates. Then there's remote monitoring. The module can be used for monitoring critical military equipment and infrastructure in remote locations. This includes monitoring unmanned systems such as drones or autonomous vehicles and ensuring operational readiness. The Iridium device also has machine-to-machine communications. The Iridium 9602 supports machine-to-machine communication, which is essential for automating processes and enabling communication between military systems such as logistics and supply chain management. There's global data communication. The module's ability to transmit short burst data ensures low latency communication, which is critical for sending and receiving mission critical data in real time. The unit also has maritime and aerial operations capability. The Iridium 9602 is often integrated into systems used for maritime and aerial military operations, providing reliable communication for vessels and aircraft operating in remote areas. Why the Iridium 9602 is suitable for military use? Global coverage. The Iridium satellite network ensures communication in any location, including polar regions and remote battlefields. It's compact and lightweight. Its small size and low weight makes it easy to integrate into portable or embedded systems. It is ruggedly designed. The module operates in extreme temperatures and harsh conditions, making it suitable for military environments. And it has secure communication. While not explicitly mentioned in the search results, Iridium's network is often used in secure communication systems which is a critical requirement for military operations. The Iridium 9602 module's robust features and global connectivity makes it a valuable tool for military applications, particularly in tracking, monitoring, and communication in remote or challenging environments. Microsoft says the undeletable 8.63 gigabyte of cache in Windows 11 24H2 is a reporting error. Space is freed by disk cleanup. Some phantom files take up phantom space on Windows 11 24H2. The Windows 11 24H2 has a peculiar issue where users cannot delete an 8.63 gigabyte update cache using any conventional method. Microsoft is aware of this problem and has noted on the Windows 11 release health page that it's a reporting error instead of a folder that can never be deleted. The company says that the files have already been removed, but that the Windows Disk Cleanup app still incorrectly displays the amount of storage space that can be freed under the Windows Update Cleanup category. That means users do not have to worry about some cache files or folders taking up space unnecessarily in their PCs. This is important, especially for smaller capacities, as 8.63 gigabytes is still a good chunk of storage. So, Microsoft says that when you run Windows Disk Cleanup for the first time with the Windows Update Cleanup selected, Windows 11 deletes and frees up the space it occupies. However, Disk Cleanup will still report the space as occupied even after cleaning it up, making users think the files were left behind in their PC storage. The 8.63 gigabyte cache is created by the new Checkpoint Cumulative Updates feature in the Windows 11 24H2. These checkpoint updates let users receive security and feature updates in smaller incremental chunks, allowing systems to stay updated without needing a massive download. However, this folder should be temporary and will eventually be deleted by Windows Cleanup. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, So for those of you out there in the audience, sometimes Marty just gives me a phrase or a couple of words to work with. And sometimes I look at it, I'm going, I am totally confused. And this is one of those. Marty said high-tech Oreo. That's all I got. High-tech Oreo. I am really puzzled because, okay, so we do have – we have this podcast, Keith and I, called Just Pour the Milk. And I normally cringe at even referencing a podcast when we're broadcast. But Oreos go good with milk. So I am wondering if you and Keith have been talking or something, if this is some weird thing, or if you've got something better than that.
I'd love to talk to him, but he only speaks Apple, and I don't know that language.
Very nice. Oh, man.
Now, this particular three-layer sandwich, which is in many ways delicious, is the ASUS ZenBook Duo notebook PC. Because what they've done, imagine you've got not just the one side that is your monitor, but it's duplicated through a hinge with another side. So you can open it up, you can double them up, you can do anything you want with them.
So you can have like a side-by-side monitor arrangement, or you can probably, I'm presuming that there's some kind of a tablet arrangement where one screen's on the outside and
stuff like that. No, it doesn't. I'm going to break the hinge doing that.
Okay, go on.
The keyboard is thin as anything and goes between these two monitors. It's held in place with magnets. When you want to lift it away, it's wireless. It's got a trackpad on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you end up with a really cool way to get a lot of compute space out of something that is just as thin as any notebook you've ever seen.
Okay.
It is brilliant. Now,
so it's a Bluetooth keyboard, or is it more of the
trackpad combo?
Okay. So it's a Bluetooth keyboard, and the brains, the CPU, and the memory, they're in the display portion, or are they in the keyboard portion? Okay.
In the display portion.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, a lot of people out there have become addicted to the convenience of working with more than one monitor. I know you have.
I am one of those, yes. Long ago. Over 20 years.
That'll happen if you have two eyes and don't have Cinerama. How wide is your screen?
Yeah.
So, look, these are OLED displays. They're brilliant.
Okay.
The two displays are both Gorilla Glass, so you're not going to be dropping ping pong balls on them, right?
Yeah. Okay.
They're each 3K resolution at 120 frames per second.
Okay.
Wild.
This is really good specs on the monitors. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
Yeah. They are both 14-inch touch screens.
Mm-hmm.
The engine Intel Core Ultra 9, 32 gig of memory, PCIe SSD. Mine's 1 terabyte, but you can get up to 2.
Okay.
The second screen under the keyboard monitor, with a magnet, has the switch on the side that makes it cordless. If you don't turn that on, you just interact with the screen using the touch screen.
Okay, so hold on. So let me make sure I've got this right. So the keyboard separates out, but even the two screens can separate out from each other. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay, I misunderstood that. Okay.
And by the way, the bottom screen, if you consider it a bottom, has a big kickstand on it so you can stand the double screen up.
Okay, all right. That sounds cool.
It's agile. This is quasi-vertical, baby. I mean, whatever you've got to dock, this thing has 2 Thunderbolt 4 ports.
Mm-hmm.
It's got 1 USB 3.2 Type A. Mm-hmm. It's got an HDMI 2.1. It's got an audio jack. So it's a big performer, big screen space, big storage, but it's slender. It's lightweight, unlike people who eat their Oreos. And it's an easy traveler. Whenever you need something totally totable, how else are you going to have 2 monitors in a skinny little bag?
Sure.
You know, it's just really handy.
So with the specs you're talking about, this sounds to me probably, I was going to say initially $1,800. I'm thinking more like $2,000.
This is the ASUS ZenBook Duo. It runs more or less $1,500.
Really? Okay. That's a nice bargain.
Yeah, it depends on the configuration you choose. Who doesn't love ASUS?
Really,
it comes right down to it. Of course, they make the motherboards for so many others.
Yes.
The idea of building their own might save them a buck or two.
Sure. So you've been putting it through its paces. You like it a lot, apparently.
I do like it a lot. Now, it's my traveler.
Okay.
I still use a different brand at the desktop when I need a notebook at the desktop, but most of the time on my old system unit, and I can hear this thing losing limbs as we go. at some point, ASUS is going to keep getting more attention.
Oh, man. Wow, this sounds very interesting. I'm going to look into this because dual monitor laptops, I've seen some proof of concept items, but I haven't seen a whole lot in the actual retail space. So it sounds very good.
Oh yeah, when it's time to execute, this thing just zips.
Oh, I bet. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. TCF 2025 is Saturday, March the 29th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The theme for this year is Fun with Technology. The keynote speaker is Dale Dougherty, founder of Make Magazine and the Worldwide Make Affairs. He'll be speaking on After 20 Years, the Maker Movement is Still Fun. The website is tcf-nj.org for listing of scheduled talks and events.
Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, March the 7th. Meeting time at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, March the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, March the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. Phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, March the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.